Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So a man dressed in a purple cowboy outfit represented himself in the court of law. He called Jesus, JFK, and the Pope to the stand. And no, this is not the beginning of a bad joke. It's the real story that could have a tragic outcome. The man in the purple cowboy suit is Scott Panetti. He's been a Texas death row inmate for more than 20 years. He was scheduled to be executed last Wednesday, but his execution has at least temporarily been postponed. Last week, when we were speaking with Art Kaplan, we agreed to talk about it again this week, or talk about it this week. Art's now with us. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Well, this is one of those rare times when you have some agreement. I mean, even conservatives, a Washington Times opinion editor and a Ronald Reagan biographer, have asked Governor Perry in Texas not to execute this guy, as well as many people on the other side, the more liberal bent. I don't get, and it's, of course, the Board of Pardons that voted to deny him clemency. I just don't get this.
I don't get it either. Basically, this guy, to put a technical medical diagnosis on it, is nutty as a fruitcake. I mean, just really mentally ill beyond anybody's dispute or debate. No one's debating it. He's floridly schizophrenic. And to hold him accountable for his crimes, I'm not saying we should put him on the street, but it makes no sense to execute a person like that. I'm not even sure he can fully appreciate the fact that he's being executed. And part of the punishment idea with capital punishment, if you favor it, is that you're going to have the person fully understand that they're going to lose their life for their crime. He can't do that.
Well, you know, it seems to me, you know, talking about proponents of the death penalty, and we've talked a lot about this for the years, Marjorie and I both oppose it. It seems to me this even hurts the cause of those, and maybe this is where you're going, of the proponents. I mean, ultimately, if this guy gets executed, a guy who is, despite the 7-0 vote by the clemency board not to stay the execution, he's so clearly mentally ill that ultimately it seems this hurts their effort to keep us as the only Western democracy with the death penalty, no?
We should add that the wife and daughter of his victims,
right,
she has said she doesn't want him to be killed either.
Because he's mentally ill.
She witnessed the murders right there in front of her. So anyway, maybe it's Rick Perry running for president or something. I just don't understand.
It doesn't make any sense to me, and I was headed exactly where you guys are taking me. If you're a proponent of the death penalty, there's really two ethical reasons you could favor it. One is to deter crime. So we have a terrible punishment. You're not going to do bad things because, you know, they'll kill you if they convict you. Well, I don't think this guy would have been deterred. Sadly, tragically, he might have been deterred if he'd been given full psychiatric help or kept in an institution or whatever. But the punishment here isn't going to deter other terribly mentally ill people from doing bad things. The other is retribution. You deserve it. You did something horrid. You should lose your life for it. It's pure eye for an eye kind of thinking. But again, he doesn't appreciate it. He doesn't understand what's happening. He's not going to feel any sense of I'm being punished because I did something horrible and I really deserve to die kind of thing. I don't think the case, if you don't have those two rationales and you got to go with one or both, I think, to make the case for capital punishment, then you got nothing.
Yeah, it also seems unconstitutional. I mean,
well, by the way, this Supreme Court, which I think most would agree has a conservative bent, mm-hmm. has moved in an anti-death penalty direction on issues of young killers. And we've actually, that's had mm-hmm. an impact on Massachusetts in terms of mandatory life sentences, that sort of thing. And obviously we don't have a death penalty here, but on the death penalty nationally, where are they on, where is the, I assume the Supreme Court law is if you are mentally ill to the point where you're wearing a purple cowboy outfit and calling Jesus to the stand, and that's believed to be the real deal, that you shouldn't be executed. Is that not the law of the land?
I would hope it's the law of the land, and I can't answer your question. I'm not sure, but I would hope so. By the way, it raises another issue. How was this guy allowed to argue his own defense?
Mm-hmm. I know.
That alone seems to me to be reason to toss him out. But I want to take us to a slightly different twist on this kind of case, mental illness and terrible crimes. There are people in prison who clearly are mentally ill and have done awful things, and the question comes, should we give them drugs to restore them to some level of more sanity or at least apparently more mentally competent, and then execute them? So this has come up a few times now where doctors are asked, should I give treatment to the person solely for the purpose of saying that they are now fit to be executed?
And what's the, I mean, it seems to me, yes, as a non-medical ethicist, there's a problem there, isn't
yeah.
there?
Yeah. So to me, the doctor's obligation is to do what's in the best interest of the patient, not to act for the state, not to act for the criminal justice system. On the other hand, if you did have medications that might help the patient, should you withhold them knowing that if you give them, they're probably going to execute him? So we've had a situation. I forgot the guy's name, but somebody was wallowing around in a federal prison, demented, severely mentally ill, and his doctors fought to keep him that way because they didn't want him to be executed. But the resolution of this can't be that I'm not going to medicate you to save your life, even though you stay insane.
You know, one of the things I don't know, and I'm sure you do doctors do the actual – when lethal injection is the method of execution, I'm assuming doctors don't do that. Do they or do they?
They don't. So it's – again, it's kind of – angels on the head of a pin, but we have a person who's an executioner who mm-hmm. actually is a technician who attaches, let's say, the IV to pump drugs through or pulls the switch in the gas chamber or, for that matter, shoots the gun in the firing squad, but it isn't the doctors. The doctors basically watch to make sure that the person doesn't seem to be waking up from, say, the injection type thing or pronounce them dead after it's over. So they don't really use them. They hire somebody to be an executioner. I've always argued they don't need doctors at all because you could train somebody just to be the executioner. All you need them for is pronouncement of death.
It wouldn't solve the death penalty kind of thing, but I've often thought we'd be much better off if we allowed more guilty but insane pleas in these different cases.
We should explain that to listeners why you think. I mean,
because there are many people
right now
who
in
are,
many states, it's not like ours, not guilty
yeah,
by
reason
of insanity.
It's really hard to do that because juries don't want to let someone who's insane off the hook and back into the general populace, and they're not convinced that the mental hospital will keep them for long enough. But if you had guilty but insane, you yeah. could say 20 years or 25 years.
And we found him or her guilty.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
So let me jump in and say something to the four listeners who are still with us and have turned off this discussion to listen to the All Christmas Carol channel. And what I'd say is this. As we begin to understand the brain better with all our scans and imaging and so on, what's going to happen is people are going to start to show up in court and say, look, my brain is bad. It's deformed. It's injured. It's traumatized. Something's off. And I think we're going to start to shift to a therapeutic model along the lines that you guys are talking about. We're going to wind up saying, you know what, these people are either not responsible or less than responsible because a lot of them have just brain disorders. And while we certainly don't want them running around or getting guns or doing things that put everybody else at risk, whether it's a sex offender or criminal person, I think we're going to start to move over to the mental illness model with institutionalization, therapy, maybe long-term nursing home kind of confinement. But I think the punishment model is going to start to fade a little bit as our brain science gets better.
I hope so. I hope so, because it would be a much more humane system, if you ask me. It would also keep juries from being in this horrible situation where they can tell. I mean, I've covered trials where it was totally clear the defendant remember the Ziti killer? That was the most famous one. He killed his wife because
he overcooked the Ziti.
It was some weird thing, and he drove around the neighborhood after he killed her with covered in blood. I mean, it was ridiculous, but you know, people were afraid to let him out, you know, guilty by reason of insanity, because of course they thought, well, is he going to be in the hospital for 2 years and then back in the street? So
all right, let's shift to another really upbeat topic, Art, if we can. You know,
well, this can be upbeat.
For years, as you have learned from afar, I make an occasional stop at a doctor's office, Art. And one of the things that has driven me nuts that actually came to a head when I was reading a piece the other day in the Wall Street Journal is you go to a lot of doctor's offices. On the table while you're sitting there waiting, there's an ad for some drug. in offices that are a little more affluent, you have television screens on the wall. And in between Kelly and Michael or whatever that television show is,
right,
there are ads for drugs on the wall. And it always bothered me. And then I read this piece that since 2010, what are called point-of-care marketing ads, where they, you know, they have ads in doctors' offices, are increasing 10% or something in the last few years, reaching $400 million a year. Forget the amount of money. How is it possibly ethical that in a doctor's waiting room, you have essentially, you're bombarded with ads? The implication to me as the patient is that product, that drug, is endorsed, if you have a condition that's relevant, by the doctor or nurse or whomever you're about to see. How can that possibly be ethical?
I'm with you. I think it really is ethically questionable. There's certain things you can put in the waiting room that I'm thrilled to see there. Here's information on how to exercise, and here's information on what to eat, and here's information, I don't know, on how you should walk more, and health prevention, health promotion stuff. You know, that's great. You got time. You're sitting there. Do it. Maybe they want to do a survey or a questionnaire to understand why, you know, have you had success in stopping smoking? What programs have worked for you? And they could use that to advise others. So I'm not saying the waiting room doesn't have to just be the funeral home for Popular Mechanics previous issues. You can have stuff out there. But selling products, I think, is ethically dubious. First of all, you're right, it's a kind of weird endorsement, sort of saying, you know, this wouldn't be here if our doctor team or practice or your doctor didn't think it was keen. And then you've got people a little bit in a vulnerable role. Are they going to really run into the doctor's office and say, hey, how come you're trying to sell me, you know, this Fitbit to wear around or have me buy biological life insurance by freezing stem cells from my new baby or something? They're not willing to challenge that kind of thing. It's not the same sort of commercial setting. And I think it basically turns it into a little bit of a business, and it's not the right atmosphere. It's not, dare I say it, professional.
Are doctors getting paid to have these things run in the waiting room?
Sometimes they do. Yep. They get reimbursement, shall we say. I was going to say kickback, but reimbursement to have certain things on display in the office. Yep, that can happen. They're certainly not going to put, you know, something in there just for the love of it. I think they're going to look to get something.
You know, by the way, the ZS Strategies or whatever it is that did this surveying says that 84, this is not surprising, but when you read it in black and white, it's painful. 84% of patients who visited waiting rooms and were exposed to these communications we're talking about report that the messages made them interested in the product. So the bottom line is the advertising works.
No doubt.
You know what the classic is? This is a different thing because they're not selling drugs. But I have a redheaded person's complexion, even though I don't have red hair, so I'm always with the skin cancers. You know, you go in to get your moles checked or your freckles checked, and you can find out. You know, you can do blue light treatment and laser treatment and liposuction on this and liposuction on that. And you can have like a whole head transplant. I mean, the doctor's office, is, if not this person you're seeing, is usually the big skincare thing, and they can do all these things. But you realize, like, every month there's some other thing to, like, basically give you entirely new skin. You know, you get totally enticed by this. You're just there to have your freckles looked at. It's different. It's not drugs, but it's the same sort of thing. It's seducing you in the waiting room because you're always waiting like 20 or 30 minutes.
So why don't you do something about this? Now that I'm talking to you, why aren't you leading the charge, Art Kaplan? We always say you're the premier man in your field, and you are. This is horrible.
So my mission is to visit doctor after doctor and clean out their offices. I usually come with a big duffel bag and take stuff out and run down the street fast and redistribute it to innocent poor people with mental illness and let them stare at the stuff.
That's what I was hoping we were here.
Okay, let's move on to something else. I think this is very exciting for people that are on the go. You may feel like you need your shrink, but you don't really have time and you don't want to drive
far
away.
Or you're away. You're going to make fun of this. I think it's great.
No, well, I said this to you, Jim. Every day you have your commute out to Newton after we finish on the radio. Jim has a television show. He has like a 20-minute, half-hour commute. You can have your
Newton,
therapy.
Who's paying this guy? Never mind. Go on.
You can have your therapy appointment via your iPad or Skype, in some cases, while you're driving. Over, they have a picture of you.
Right there. That must be a wonderful thing. As you burst into tears talking about your mother and plow into the side of the road.
Yeah.
That kind of...
Well, they actually did talk to a person who was doing this while driving long distances in their job from city to city. I think it would be safer to pull off the road and have
a conversation. But this is one of the few. I mean, we talk about technology and the upside and the downside all the time on the show. This is a huge plus, is it not, Art Kaplan?
So just to be clear, this is basically doing psychological counseling, kind of therapy, on the move.
Right.
And remotely.
Exactly.
And I think it has an upside. I do. I think, for example, if you live 3 hours from any therapist, telemedicine of this sort is really, you know, it may not be ideal that you're not face-to-face and getting every little cue and personal interaction that might make therapy work best of the talk therapy type, but... Ain't bad, ain't bad. And if you want to check in or say something's bothering you or you have suicidal thoughts or you're afraid that someone might be hurting you or whatever, I can see a role for this. I'm not anti-remote use of technology. I'm a little nervous, like I said, if you're doing it when you're driving. That seems to me...
Yeah, but there seems to be more skepticism in the tone of your voice. And I have to say, when I read it... You know, by the way, if the reason you're doing Skype is because... You're really not interested in it, and you're trying to squeeze it in between going to the gym and going out for a drink, then fine. But if it turns out you're on the move, you're away from where your regular shrink or therapist
found
or whatever.
Someone you really like,
right?
Which
you don't
want
to lose him or her,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, am I reading you wrong or no?
No, you read me partly right in that I don't think it's ideal. I still believe it's best to be in the room one-on-one, more. The therapist can kind of pick up subtle things that even Skype right now doesn't capture.
Yeah.
But it's not bad. It's not, you know, below the threshold of awful. The other thing I worry about is you're doing it in a train or some place where people are listening in. And I'm not just worried about your privacy. I'm also worried about, you know, let me put it this way. When I moved to New York, I can't go to the supermarket now. I stand in a line. Somebody walks over to me and says, you know, I just went to my therapist, and I never liked my mother. And I'm just like, hey, I'm just here to get some salami, buddy. I don't care. So it's like you have to be careful with those technologies because others can hear, third parties can hear. They're not encrypted. Somebody could hack to that. You know, you got all that sort of privacy stuff. But what I'm really saying is, you want to make sure you're in a quiet environment. You're not just doing it on a train or somehow from an airplane and everybody else is listening in and that sort of stuff. It might inhibit what you say. There may be people who hear it that you don't want to. You're doing it next to your kids, that sort of stuff.
By the way, the greatest appeal of this to me is being able to listen in on somebody else's session. So forget
well, you.
Exactly.
You. You want to pick up the next 15 symptoms that I might have. I know what that's all about.
I've got them already, but thank you very much. Hey, Art Kaplan, before you go, there's yesterday we were treated to, we had two screens in our studio. On one screen, we have Dianne Feinstein releasing the torture report. They don't use the word torture, mm-hmm. but the enhanced interrogation report, whatever it is. On the other screen, we had Jonathan Gruber, who's a fairly regular guest on the show, even though he's a little bit of a hiatus right now, for fairly obvious reasons, getting skewered by particularly Republicans on this House Oversight Committee about his stupid comments about stupid voters. Mm-hmm. But putting that aside, this is more troubling. There's a piece in the New York Times. Obviously, Medicaid coverage is a huge part of the expansion of the Affordable Care Act if it is to work. And there's this article in the New York Times, which I'm sure you've seen. Mm-hmm. Half of doctors listed as serving Medicaid patients are unavailable, investigation finds. This I don't know who did it. I'm sorry, but
I think it was the Office of the Inspector General.
Well, it was. You're right. You're totally right. Daniel Levinson. They called doctors' offices, and they either were – the doctors were unavailable or had no appointment times. Isn't this going to make that part of this for low- and moderate-income people totally implode?
It is a huge problem, although I was a little surprised to see that this came as news. Anybody who talks with docs, they'll tell you either I don't take Medicaid or I've closed my practice. I only take a certain percentage of Medicaid patients because I don't like the reimbursement, and so I only take 10% and I'm full. A lot of the docs who do Medicaid kind of went private and said, nope, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to do a boutique practice. So it's great to say we're going to encourage more people who didn't have insurance, particularly poorer people, to have the right to get to a doctor and have preventive care and more primary care, as we say. But if you don't increase the person power to deliver that care, then all you're doing is making long lines of people who are already overwhelmed, the primary care docs. So my solution is, I don't know what you're going to do to get the docs to take Medicaid, but I think you got to expand the workforce to include more nurses, let the pharmacists do more, like give shots. Maybe the dentists can do more vaccinations or certain types of health procedures, physician assistants. We got to get more people out there because just saying, well, here's an opportunity and a right. You can do this. Of course, there's no one to give it to you, but, you know, when you get sick, you can now bite on your new health reform card.
You know what's analogous to? It's sort of analogous to. The good news is you now have medical insurance. The bad news is you can't afford to use it because of the co-pays and the high deductibles.
Right.
The good news, by the way, just so to show that we are attempting to help the cause, Marjorie and I now do flu shots in October at the end of the show from 2 to 3 every day.
I was distressed about the flu shot because
it, you can get it at CVS or
apparently
Walgreens.
Doesn't cover a lot of the strains that are out there.
It does, and although it's still worth getting, it's just it does happen every year, just so listeners know. You have to guess ahead of time what strains are floating around. This year, the guess wasn't correct. So one of the nastier strains, the flu shot isn't really good for. But it does help the other ones.
We should still do it. So, all right, what's your Everyday Ethics podcast for today?
So a little interesting one. NCAA came out with some protocols about what to do if you think an athlete has a concussion. And they include things like resting after the concussion to rest your brain. And the problem is there's no science for any of this yet. The brain isn't a muscle, even though many listeners may be thinking they need a rest after listening to me of their brains. It doesn't work that way. It's an electrical system. You know, you don't rest your switch. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't get better if you're, say, the switch fails in a lamp or something. And that's the model they're using. So I know that people want to do something about concussions, and particularly in football and hockey, but I'm not sure the science is there yet to know what to do.
But wait a second. You know, one of the things, I think this is, your son had this experience.
Yes.
Don't a lot of the schools, thanks to people like
they
Chris Nowinski,
test.
Who's been on the show a lot, who obviously is part of the Sports Legacy Institute with Dr. Cantu at BU, don't they have these tests?
Baselines
where you take a test before, and then they're able to compare your results after?
They do, but what we don't know is, does that really measure concussion that's going to bother you for a long time, or is that just a short-term thing? And B, more importantly, and then what do we do about it? Are you supposed to lie down? Are you supposed to, obviously you don't want to play, but what's the thing to do next? We don't really understand. And the problem basically is football in particular ignored concussions for so long that the science is way, way behind.
Well, the solution is ping pong as far as I'm concerned. I'm serious.
All right. Art Kaplan.
Art, great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Art Kaplan joins us every Wednesday. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. And he's also the co-host of what I just mentioned, the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Coming up, we're asking you about the office Christmas party. Is it time to do away with them or to revive them with an open bar and come one, come all glory? We're asking you next. How you feel about the annual holiday Christmas party? Boston Public Radio continues at 89.7 WGBH.